The Inner Level by epidemiologists and authors Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett offers a surprising thesis. Countries with the greatest wealth and broadest economic inequality suffer a greater amount of mental health, illness, homicide, and have a lower life expectancy than those countries that are less wealthy and have a smaller economic gap between the richest and the poorest. Many of us think the reverse would be true, that countries with wealth surely would equal successful school systems and less stressful social environments. Why is this not true? Through empirical studies from around the world, the Inner Level says the pursuit of wealth and status affects how we see ourselves, and depending on where you are on the social ladder, you experience stress, success, and life very differently. Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pinkett are here via phone to discuss their book, The Inner Level, here on the Keenest Observers on Jefferson Exchange. Richard Wilkinson has played a formative role in international research on the social determinants of health. He studied economic history at the London School of Economics before training in epidemiology and is professor emeritus at the University of Nottingham Medical School and honorary professor at University College London. Mr. Wilkinson, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us. It's nice to be with you.
Most definitely. And Kate Pickett is professor of epidemiology, research champion for justice and equality, and deputy director of the Center for Future Health at the University of York. She studied physical anthropology at Cambridge, nutritional sciences at Cornell, and epidemiology at the University of California, Berkeley. Ms. Pickett, thank you for being here.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having us.
Thank you. So is my summary accurate? Is this idea of the pursuit of status and wealth in wealthy countries causing stress, or do I have this off, or do you all have
it? It's the effect of inequality, bigger income differences between rich and poor, which seem to increase feelings of superiority and inferiority, dominance and subordination, if you like. In a sense, it increases the importance of status and class on everyone, and not only making us judge each other more by social position, but also worrying about how we are judged by others. And that's really at the root of the issue.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. I'd like to ask a quick question, too. You all are both epidemiologists. What does that mean in terms of this study, and how does epidemiology play a role in the exploration and investigation of this dynamic?
Well, epidemiologists study the distribution and the determinants of disease and states of health in populations. So whereas a doctor will try and figure out why you have a particular illness, what has caused it, what it is, epidemiologists study diseases and states of health in groups of people. And so we try to figure out what causes various kinds of illness, what determines who becomes sick and who does not. And Richard and I are both social epidemiologists, so we study the social determinants of health, things like social support, socioeconomic status, social class, ethnicity, things like that in relation to health. And so our approach to looking at health and social problems in different populations is to try and understand the determinants of those, and we can approach psychological and health problems that seem to people very much like something that just affects them individually. We can look at the problem from a societal point of view and try to determine what are the things that are different about different countries, different American states, that lead to different levels of health in those places.
Right. So your exploration is an interesting combination of, like, again, social anthropology and medical study, which, you know, is an interesting combination. Is this common practice with epidemiologists?
It's becoming more common. In fact, I was one of the first people trained in epidemiology who had not come to it from medicine. And it means you ask quite different questions. Gradually, even the medical profession has become aware that the really important determinants of health and life expectancy in populations are not so much medical care as the nature of social and economic life, how stressful life is and what we're exposed to and so on.
So for the purposes of our discussion, can we define what you all mean in the inner level when you say inequality?
Yes, we're talking about income differences, the gap between the incomes of the rich and the poor in different societies. And economists and people like us measure that level of income inequality in different ways. Sometimes they compare the top fifth of the population, their incomes, to the bottom fifth. But it doesn't seem to matter which way you measure income inequality. You always find the same relationships. But it is the difference between incomes rather than wealth and rather than any other kind of inequality.
Mm-hmm. So, and this is a dynamic, as the inner level kind of explores, that finds itself manifesting across the world. Most people would be very surprised to hear that. But in your book, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, the picture is that, of course, in poorer countries, in much poorer countries, it's really important that people should have more of the basic necessities. But in rich countries, having more and more of everything makes less and less difference. So gradually, the value of further economic growth drops out of the picture. But what we're left with is the effects of inequality, which in a sense you should see as a sort of damaging social relationship. As I say, increasing the importance of status and class and superiority and inferiority, undermining our sense of self-worth because it contains the idea that some people are worth so much more than others.
Yeah, and we'll get back at the next segment to get into this dynamic, which I think is very interesting, the stressors that self-worth and identity play on our concept of how we think of ourselves and success. We're talking to Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pinkett. Their book, The Inner Level, explores how inequality impacts us individually, altering how we think, feel, and behave. Stay with us. Just joining us, I'm Robert Goodwin. Our guests are authors Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pinkett. We're talking about their book, The Inner Level, that explores how inequality impacts us individually, altering how we think, feel, and behave. You can join the conversation at 800-838-3760 or email comments and questions to jx@jeffnet.org. Richard and Kate, we were about to get into, I think, one of the main thesis points of your book and a data point that's really interesting to me, which is the pursuit, at least in well-off countries, of status and wealth is actually a stressor to all levels of social strata. I'm trying not to use class yet, but what you found across the world is well-off countries actually exert stress in people as they continue to try to go up the social ladder. How did you find that point? Is that truly accurate? I'm going to be the devil's advocate for a second.
Yes, we have now good data collected internationally from 30 or 40 countries showing that the countries with the biggest income differences, people right across the income scale, from the poorest to the richest tenth of the population, feel more worried about status, more worried about how they're seen and judged. And the problem isn't simply people trying to get up. It's also people feeling devalued and looked down on. And of course, our societies seem to, despite their unparalleled levels of physical comfort, seem to suffer from unprecedented levels of stress, mental illness. You know, surveys suggest that about nearly 60% of the American population feel paralyzed by stress. And we all worry about the rise in mental illness in our society and use of drugs. So we're relating it to those kinds of problems.
Right. I think that's an interesting point. And the stressors being across class, if you will, and the consequently the repercussions on all people, you know.
That's right. So if we think about society as a sort of a social ladder or as a pyramid, people at the bottom are most affected by inequality within a society, but we're all affected. So we have colleagues here in the U.S., actually at the Harvard School of Public Health, who describe inequality as a social pollutant because it's a bit like air pollution. If you have a high level of inequality in society, none of us can escape it. Even if we're well-educated, of high social class, with good incomes, we're all affected by inequality in society and what it does to the social relationships between us.
And what would be the counter in countries that don't have the perception of wealth in terms of dollars? What is the counterbalance that you found that make those societies far more functional?
Well, basically, all the problems that are more common further down the social ladder, like poor health, poor educational performance of school children, more violence, all those problems are worse in more unequal countries. Mm. Basically, we're saying that the problems related to social status within our societies get worse when you increase the social status differences. Mm. And we're now unpacking the sort of psychological reasons behind that relationship.
And so in more equal societies, and by that I mean countries like the Scandinavian countries and Japan, but also in the more equal of the US states compared to the more unequal ones, relationships between people are easier and issues to do with status, competition, and your position in society, they just matter less. And so people are less stressed by those issues.
And so if the, basically what we're saying is if I don't have to worry necessarily about how I define myself in society and I make a significant wage to take care of myself and my basic functions for family and individual, then I'm not necessarily stressed as much and consequently I don't act out. My health function is better. Yeah.
That's right. I mean, it's all a matter of degrees. Everybody, everywhere, is worried about how others see and judge us, how we're doing in relation to other people. This is a universal phenomenon. It's just that it becomes more important and more damaging with higher levels of inequality because status matters so much more in a more unequal country.
And to give you a very simple example, homicide is much more common in more unequal countries because where status is more important than the issues to do with being dissed, looked down on, loss of face, humiliation, which are so often the triggers to violence, become more important. People are more sensitive to those kinds of things in more unequal societies. That's a very well-established relationship internationally and in the 50 American states.
Right. I understand that to be very, very accurate. I come from an interesting part of the country where I think we see a lot of that. I'm from Chicago, Illinois, and the pursuit of, I would say, class and status causes a lot of violence in community. But you don't see the reverse necessarily in status and community. And I think that's an interesting, I'm pulling the thread from a part of your book that, you know, talks about class and how folks who are at one level of class don't orient their identity in the same way as folk from the other side of the class, if we call it that loosely. Why do you think that is?
I think the higher up in society you are, you have access to different sort of markers of status. I think there's more need to try and express your status through things like what you buy, the goods that you purchase, status consumption, if you don't have access to other markers of social status like education, income, and high social class. I mean, I lived in Chicago myself for 4 years, and so, you know, I understand where you're coming from and have experienced, you know, that city. And there are parts of the city where, you know, parts of the population feel very much left behind by social progress, that they don't have chances for social mobility, that their children don't have better chances in life than they did. And that is a source of chronic stress to large numbers of the population.
We're talking to Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pinkett about their book that really explores inequality and its effects on populations across the world. It's called The Inner Level. I want to ask a question about a statement in your book. You say that this book is not a self-help book, that you're exploring causality issues between inequality and inferiority complexes in people, and therefore the ill effects in society, and ill treatment in people. Do you find, I guess this is what I'm getting to. I find that studies sometimes don't connect to helping folk. So how does this book, given the fact that it does give such a great basis for causality of inequality, doesn't purport itself to be a piece that can help folk?
Well, of course, there are vast numbers of self-help books. The bookshops and so on are full of them. And whenever we get news stories about levels of stress and mental illness and drug abuse in our society, what people always ask for is more services. But what we have to do is understand why these problems are so much worse in our societies, and that's what we're trying to do. Of course, we can make some improvements in our own lives. The numbers of friends we have is obviously very important. All sorts of things like that, the sort of social support we have. But that still leaves the big structural things that make all these problems worse for all of us untouched. And really, governments have to take hold of those issues.
So when we say that, you know, this is not a self-help book, what we mean is that if we look at different societies and we see that they have vastly different levels of mental distress and psychological problems and other health issues that are related to inequality, then people's individual well-being isn't only a consequence of their background, their own history, their own behaviors or feelings. Society itself is shaping the level of problems in different places. And I think that can be quite freeing for people to realize that there's something beyond them that is shaping their well-being or lack of it. And so the solutions are not therefore for them to try and work on their own feelings or emotions or behavior, although that might help them, but it's also to participate in a political process where you try to change those structures and therefore change the well-being of the whole population. So there are certainly solutions, they're just not individual ones.
Right. I think I kind of gave you a setup question there, because one of the things that I believe The Inner Level does is give causal data in order to found and ground any next step that could be social and programmatic and support. But if you don't have hardcore data, even if it's anecdotal, then it's going to be very challenging to substantiate any kind of programmatic initiative. So you definitely have found that and have offered that in a very comprehensive way.
Yes, I think what makes the picture really convincing is not only have we data that shows people are more worried about how they're seen and judged, but we then see their responses. You can either be overcome with low self-esteem, lack of confidence, withdraw from social life, get depressed, and we do see more of that in more unequal countries, Or you can do the opposite. If you're worried about how you're judged, then you start flaunting your achievements and abilities rather than being modest about them. And so narcissism goes up. A whole range of mental illnesses and personality disorders, which seem to interact with these issues to do with dominance and subordination, increase. And we see those patterns in the data for more and less unequal countries. I mean, it's really, the picture is very clear. And it goes, of course, into consumerism, because how we try and show ourselves off in a good light to other people is buying, you know, good-looking stuff. And there are lots of studies now which show that if you live in a more unequal area, you're more likely to spend money on a flashy car or search for clothes with the right fashion labels and so on. A lot of the picture of differences between more and less equal countries fit into this view of the causal processes.
Yeah, I think I was just going to speak on, I guess, and ask a question of, around that topic. You talk about that pursuit of, I guess, value, assaulting the mental well-being, self-confidence, and relationships of human beings, and how that affects our pursuit of the common good. And I think that was just really mind-blowing to me, that you could back that up with data. And you called it being driven by ego insecurity. And I was very interested to see how that manifested, but I think you just spoke to it really well. We just got an email from peaceatmind.net, and this individual says, coincidentally, some friends and I have been debating this exact topic. Their position is that economic equality is the outcome which Marxists, communists, and socialist liberals of all stripes aspire by redistributing of wealth. I counter that economic outcomes are only a measurement, not an ends to itself. I realize you are both epidemiologists and not legislators, but what would you propose as remedy? I believe in legislative representation and equal treatment under the law, not redistribution of wealth per se. With the confidence of equality under the law, persons would have equality of opportunity. Appreciatively, Tom E. from Medford, Oregon.
Well, that's a great question and a great point. What the data show is that you can't have equality of opportunity without greater equality of outcome. Social mobility is much lower in more unequal societies. So if we look at people's ability to move up and down in society, it's much, much more restricted in more unequal societies. But across the political spectrum, I think most people agree we would like to see greater equality of opportunity. So we have to find ways to reduce the inequality that gets in the way of that. Now, there's two main ways you can do that. You can either do it through taxes and benefits, redistribution of wealth and incomes, but not everybody's in favor of that. You can also do it through having smaller income differences to start with. That's going to mean constraining top pay and those runaway, huge, undeserved salaries and bonuses at the top, but raising the floor at the bottom, making sure that people are fairly paid a living wage for their labor.
And we think that you should do that really by extending democracy into the economy, into the economic sphere. So employee representatives on company boards, more incentives to the growth of employee-owned companies and cooperatives. In the European Union, about half the member countries have some legislation for employee representation on company boards. It's often just token, but in some countries like Germany, it goes a lot further. So large companies, half the people on the committees deciding pay have to be employee representatives. And, you know, you might think your boss should have twice as much as you, or maybe even four times as much. But in many of these big companies, in the United States and Britain, the people at the top are paying themselves 300 or 400 times as much. So extending democracy is one of the solutions to this problem.
Mm-hmm. In, I guess, about the last minute and a half of this segment, what I think there was an implication also, well, it's actually kind of explicit in Tom's question about the social theory, Marxism, communism, socialism. What do you do with criticism from folk who are, I guess, kind of ground in capitalism, who kind of criticize that point?
Our analysis is of rich market democracies. You know, we're not examining these outcomes in communist countries. We're looking at different rich market democracies. They're all capitalist societies. What we see is that those that are a little bit more equal than others, and they get there by many different routes, they have higher levels of population well-being, better economic outcomes often as well.
Effectively, they're different versions of capitalism. Mm. There's the sort of Scandinavian model, and there's the kind of British and American model. And one of them seems to be much better for human well-being.
Yes. I think that folk would be, again, very surprised. This book, your work is very comprehensive and does cover countries from across the world, and definitely gets economic structures and foundations in a very complete sense. And we'll get back to that when we return. We're talking to Kate Pinkett and Richard Wilkinson about their book, The Inner Level, that deals with income inequality. Stay tuned. Back with the final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Robert Goodwin, hosting our guests, Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pinkett, and we're talking about their book, The Inner Level, a study of the effects of income inequality across the world. You're welcome to join this conversation. Call us at 800-838-3760 or email comments and questions at jx@jeffnet.org.
Can I just correct you on Kate's name? She's Kate Pinkett, not Pinkett.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate that. Pardon me, Kate. I would like to talk a little bit about the next piece of the book that talks about the misconception of meritocracy and the idea that meritocracy is what would potentially close the income or the inequality gap. Is that an accurate statement?
Well, I think the idea of the meritocracy is something that a lot of people use to justify the current levels of inequality that we have. But, you know, in the United States, in the United Kingdom, we think as long as people who work hard and strive to do better are able to move up and be rewarded, then it's okay, and we could tolerate a certain level of inequality. But what the data suggest are that actually any idea of a meritocracy is hampered by inequality.
And that's really because the differences in ability much more to do with the sort of circumstances you've been brought up in. So where you are in the social pyramid is more a determinant of your abilities than it is caused by your differences in ability. And although there's good evidence of small genetic differences in people's aptitudes, there's very, very powerful evidence of the importance of environmental factors. And we know that we're able to do brain scans and see what's going on in which areas of the brain are involved in different activities. We can see that the human brain is so malleable. It's shaped by what we do and our experience, so that, you know, if you learn to dance, or if you learn another language or a musical instrument or something like that, your brain structure has actually changed. And so the differences in what we take to be people's intelligence are actually results of their different social circumstances.
You even get into the nature of friendship as well, and relationship being an incredible part of that kind of connection in order to navigate space. I think that would probably surprise folk as well, that there was there's data that suggests that if folk have functional relationships, as seemingly, you know, taking for granted relationships as friendships, that allows them to navigate the world in a different way.
Absolutely. Social support is crucial, but it's not just crucial for sort of, you know, making your way in the world, although it really, really matters for that. Social support and friendship are incredibly important for health as well. And I think that this is also a surprise often to people, that having friends is as protective for their health as smoking is bad for it. Mm-hmm. And so any aspect of society that sort of increases the distances between us, that reduces our connection to one another, our sense of belonging within our neighborhoods, our workplaces, our schools, our networks of family and friends, anything that gets in the way of those relationships is destructive to our health in ways that, you know, we understand pretty well now within epidemiology. We know how important social support and social networks are for health.
And again, there are lots of studies that show how damaging inequality is to community life, to how much people feel they can trust each other. The picture is very clear that as inequality increases, community life weakens, people trust each other less, violence rises. The effects on, if you like, on social relationships and the public sphere are really disastrous. And of course, it's not simply that it affects health. Studies of happiness and well-being show that the quality of social relationships is absolutely crucial. How many friends you have, the quality of your relationships, and as I say, whether or not you're involved in community life. That's really the important part of human well-being and the quality of life that we must address in future. And that's, it's things going wrong in that sphere that have been damaging mental health and well-being.
Right. It seems like I think there an interesting juxtaposition in the work that you all have written talks about the fact that human beings may be relational, but they also have the balance of being competitive. And so how does that work in the dynamic of existence?
That's right. So a lot of people think that human nature is inherently competitive, individualistic, and aggressive. You know, that's the kind of animal that we are, if you will. And so it's useless to try and address inequality because it's just human nature for us to, be competitive and strive against one another. But in fact, as human beings, we have spent just as much of our evolutionary past, or more, 90% of our time as in our evolutionary history, in much more egalitarian, reciprocal, caring and sharing communities and societies. So I think what that shows us is that there isn't a single human nature. We're actually very flexible and adaptable. We can be competitive and aggressive and out for ourselves, but we can be very egalitarian. We can look after one another. We can be one another's best support.
Friendship is really at the base of that. I mean, the issue is whether we share access to necessities and so on, recognize each other's needs, provide that mutual support, reciprocity, or whether we feel we can't trust each other and must fend for ourselves. And the kind of society we experience shapes our behavior.
I'm talking to Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett about their book, The Inner Level, which is a study of the effects of income inequality across the world. I'd like to ask this. In societies that are far less wealthy, what do you find that they value? I'm pulling the thread that I just heard you all mention. Do you find that then those societies care for each other in a particular way, value friendship and relationship and community in a particular way, even, you know, spiritual foundations in a particular way?
I think it's universal throughout the world that most people want good friendships, they want good quality relationships with other people, they want to look after their families, they want to be able to spend quality time with their friends, their colleagues, their families. And people are happier when they have opportunities to do that, more than they're happier if they have more opportunities to buy things. It's very hard to sort of pull back from that competition to buy more, display your status more. But it is a competition that very few people have any chance of winning. And what most of us perceive as the best part of our lives throughout the world is the quality of our relationships with one another. And so all we're saying is that in some societies, that is emphasized more than the competition for status. And in societies that give more attention to the quality of relationships between people, more people will have a higher level of well-being and will feel fulfilled, and that they are prosperous within their society.
And what Kate is talking about, that distinction, is so strongly influenced by whether the income differences between us are bigger or smaller. It does affect how much we strive in terms of consumerism to better ourselves in others' eyes, or fear being looked down on, and all those issues.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Is this the concept you offer connected to locus of control? And if so, can you explain that?
Yes, it seems to be. While inequality increases, it looks as if locus of control increases. Locus of control is the extent to which you feel you're in command of your life, or whether you just feel you're a victim of circumstances. What fate decides is what happens to you in your life.
Yeah, so external locus of control increases as inequality increases versus internal locus of control.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so you also offer ways of adjusting this particular challenge and income gap, and what that could mean in terms of solutions to challenges within not only the side that does have the most inequality, but even the more egalitarian, balanced societies. And could you offer some of those?
Yes, and I think as we mentioned earlier in the program, there's a whole range of different ways in which societies can become a little bit more equal or become a bit more unequal. Primarily, that's either through redistributing income and wealth through taxes and benefits, or it's through extending democracy into the workplace so that we can reduce income differences before taxes. And it doesn't seem to matter which strategy you choose. You get the benefits of greater equality however you do it. So we can look at different American states and see that, for example, among the most equal, you have New Hampshire and Vermont. But they take rather different strategies towards gaining that greater equality. One looks more like Sweden with its redistribution and tax rates, and the other looks rather more like Japan with small income differences before tax. But they both achieve a higher level of well-being for their citizens because they're more equal, and it doesn't really matter how you choose to get there.
Maybe this is outside the scope of you all's work, but how do you see, after that equality happens in those spaces, that the behavior adjusts? In other words, maybe What happens to the population? What are the programmatic efforts that we see by government? What are the health benefits or adjustments? Or I mean, maybe I not adjustments is probably not the best word, but
less divided by status. Okay. So people, community life starts to improve. Our society gets more cohesive. And there are multiple benefits. Not only do people suffer less stress and so life expectancy improves faster, but there are fewer people in prison, lower homicide rates, measures of child well-being show kids do better, obesity rates are lower, people, you know, if you're feeling very stressed and feel social contact is quite an ordeal, pushes up your anxiety levels, of course, one thing you do is resort to drugs and alcohol. You use them to help you relax with other people and stop yourself worrying so much about status, having these anxieties. And so, again, we can see how the use of drugs and alcohol increases with inequality.
What would you say then to, and this is an extrapolation, because I understand that as epidemiologists, you've set the ground for the next level of conversation, which would be then how do we change the constructs and programming that suggest that status equals success, which equals...
It is slightly out of our remit, you know, but I think what our work shows is the how profound the impact of inequality is on our well-being. But also, we know that within other academic disciplines, economists are showing how bad inequality is for economic growth and stability. We know that people are showing how dangerous it is for inequality to become, you know, very extreme if we're going to make the transition to sustainable economies. So we think there's a sort of a nexus of information and evidence that suggests it's really important that we do make those changes. And I think what gives us hope is that if we look back over the past few decades, you know, many societies have seen a huge amount of social progress that hasn't usually come about because people at the top have decided to extend rights to people. It's come about because of grassroots movements and demand and people throughout society feeling that they want things to change.
Thank you.
I think we're hopeful that things can change in that way with regard to inequality as well.
I appreciate it. Kate Pickett, Richard Wilkinson, thanks for joining us. Your book, The Inner Level, has given us a lot of things to think about.